Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin? And how did they end? Let's find out on this episode of Fan of History. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bernie. I'm so excited because this time you have done some amazing research and I don't know anything about it yet.
Well, thank you. We'll have some fun with it. I did do a lot of research on this, but I didn't prepare a script like we sometimes do. So I think this is going to be good. I've been excited about this for a long time. And honestly, I'm a little nervous because this information is so good. I really want to make sure that I get it out as best I can to everybody. So we're going to talk today about the Assyrian Intelligence Services. And my main source for this is a book by Peter Dubovsky, and it's called Hezekiah and the Assyrian Spies. But it's a very scholarly book, and it's this guy breaks down all these tablets, and they're not, you know, they're not the king's annals and things like that. They're these like little messages and tablets that it really shows how the intelligence services of Assyria work. So kind of jump into this. So in this period, what we're talking about here too is really a very small window. It's, even in our last episode, Dan said maybe the empire got too big. This is kind of the era that we're talking about. Because in the first half, like in the 9th century, the first half of the 8th century, most scholars will agree that the Assyrian military was kind of like raids, capturing people, things like that. And it wasn't really until TP3. He transformed the policy. They called it the down-the-line approach. That's what Simo Parpola calls it. He's another great Assyriologist. The strategy was they wanted to expand the core area systematically by reducing these little independent countries and even the vassal countries to actual provinces directly controlled by the government. And There was like a standardized procedure, just like everything else seems they do, right? That we found out. There was a massive deportation. They'd install an Assyrian governor. They'd construct Assyrian garrisons and forts. And then, now there was always the threat of rebellion, though, with these kind of things. So they required an efficient intelligence network to keep them, you know, keep a lid on this. And TP3 was like the main guy that really ramped this up. I mean, intelligence is like, been around, I think, since there's been people. Intelligence is kind of like just knowing what's going on around you. But then as a government doing it, you know, as a country or empire, the Assyrians did it more systematically and better than the other people around them and, you know, kind of prior to them.
It must have been around since the invention of agriculture.
Absolutely.
Because then you were like, how much stuff is in that village over there? And how well defended is it? That's intelligence you have to have if you want to take their stuff.
Exactly. There's actually evidence of from 8,000 BC of a watchtower in the Levant, around Jericho. And even Jericho had walls, 18,000 BC, So for sure. But it was just so that would be, let's just say, you're the strong man or the king or the ruler of a village. How much you systemize that intelligence and how much importance you put on it, I think you're going to see made a big difference. And I really think now this is why the Neo-Assyrian Empire actually happened. This is why it got to how it got to. I mean, we try to study the battle plans and how come the Assyrians always won these battles? How come they always, they didn't lose that much? And we don't really think of a Alexander the Great, that he had these great strategies and, overwhelming battles that they were overwhelming odds that they defeated. They just sort of always won. But that's because, if you ever read The Ancient Art of War, it's China, and it's actually supposedly written later than this, our period here.
Much later, the 3rd century BC, right?
Right. That's when they think it was written, and about the warring periods. But yeah, the three.
Oh, sorry. He died in 496 BC.
I think they think it was written around the two and three hundreds, actually. But how that was kind of like Sun Tzu, though. He lived back then. But today the intelligence services all have to read that book. And his one of the main things he always said was, don't go to war unless you know you can win. Right? You got to know what's going to happen as best as you can, because there's so many things that could go wrong.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah. But, not everybody does that. I really always say, what were these people thinking? And they went against the Assyrians and they always lose, because I don't think they had an organized intelligence system the way the Assyrians did. And I think the best to define intelligence, right? So intelligence could be the way you use intelligence, information. But, intelligence is also, here's the definition of it. Intelligence refers to information relevant to a government's formulation, and implementation of policy to further its national security interests and to deal with threats from actual or potential adversaries. That's intelligence, that information. As an activity, intelligence involves the collection and analysis of intelligence information. And then the term intelligence can also refer to an organization that carries out these activities. So, first of all, the Assyrians didn't have an actual CIA or KGB, and they didn't have you're the intelligence agency.
I'm so disappointed. I wanted the Assyrian CIA.
Well, the whole thing was the CIA, the king and his crown prince and those guys kind of were the CIA. That was the real important part of their military function, right? They had to be the guy in charge. Somebody had to be in charge. You can't tell everybody everything, it's secretive. So that's kind of was their main role. Now I'm saying we have a lot of information on, especially Sargon and Sennacherib. And so when Sennacherib was the crown prince, he was kind of like your spy chief. And Sargon, I think Sargon was probably TP3's, he was his guy. Even though Shalmaneser and, there's that whole, is he a son? Did he overthrow him?
Yes.
So Sargon was always out on campaign because he knew he had Sennacherib to take care of the intelligence business in the back and also running the government.
And poor Sennacherib just wants to build things.
He just wanted to build things. But I'm sure he was and he liked his wife too. But so then in the task of an intelligence, so modern, so I was actually did some reading and stuff and I watched some information on modern intelligence agencies and then even the history of intelligence. There's this guy who wrote this huge book on the history of intelligence. I searched Assyria in it. One word, nothing. This book, the Hezekiah and the Assyrian Spies by Dubovsky, he really goes into depth. So I really recommend if you like the podcast, this episode, if you like, check it out because there's a lot of detail in it and it's impossible for me to go through every little thing that happens. But he explains that there's the intelligence services do different things besides just gather intelligence. They also are involved in like psychological operations and things like that. So, and the Assyrians were masters of it all.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So what I think I'm going to do is I'll tell you about a couple of case studies and to show how they work. I think it's a good way. And then the book has tons of them. Very, very interesting stuff. And so like the first one is the Siege of Jerusalem. There's so much to show how these their services work just by that. So I'm going to actually go to 2 Kings 18, right? I'm not going to read this whole thing, but you'll see what I'm saying. If you remember, the Rabshakeh, right? He came outside the walls of Jerusalem and he made this speech.
Yes.
So that sounds like, oh, that's silly. It probably didn't happen. Now, word for word, it probably didn't happen. But there's a good chance that something like this either did happen there, but it definitely happened in other places. We even have records of it in Babylonia. If you remember, Sargon just marched right into Babylonia. Didn't even have to really shoot a, you know, fire an arrow.
Yes.
So this is kind of the way they would do it. So here, here's 2 Kings 18. So remember when the Rabshakeh comes out and he's talking to them. So he says, he brings a message. Tell Hezekiah, this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? You say you have the counsel and might for war, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Look, I know you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces the hand of anyone who leans on it. Such is the king of Egypt to all who depend on him. So now, that just sounds like words, right? But if you break that down, you see that they know that they're so the Assyrians know that they do not have enough men to fight in a war because they just conquered all the rest of their cities, right? They're saying they know that you're trying to depend on Egypt, and they know Egypt isn't going to really help them. So that means just right there that they have a whole bunch of people out gathering intelligence to know this stuff. That on just that one sentence, couple sentences. So then he continues, but if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before this altar in Jerusalem. So, I mean, there you go again. They know what's happening in the state of Judah. They know that there's people that aren't very happy about them destroying their religious spots and telling them that they have to worship in Jerusalem. And the way that they conquered, that they moved into Babylon at that time, you know, Sargon did, was by conspiring with the temples. So it was somebody that, you know, some temples probably didn't like that they knocked the Asherah poles down. So here's a great example of the information that they had, that they told them that they had the information, and the psychological, you know, effects of, you know, going outside and speaking to them in Hebrew. And here, just one more part of it. Come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. How can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you were depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? So there again, he knows that, here, I'll give you 2,000 horses. You don't even have 2,000 soldiers. And they know it because they have good spies.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
So I find that very interesting. I mean, you hear the... And I feel after studying this more, I'm like, wow, that maybe some guy really did yell outside the walls of Jerusalem that day. I mean, that's pretty, historically... We don't have any record besides this from the Bible that was said, but we have these other records that they did things like this at other cities. Right?
I would like more examples.
All right. I'm going to do this other example. And this is on the border of, you know, so remember when we were just talking on our last episode about where the Assyrian heartland is, and it butts up against Urartu and TP3. Before them, remember, if you recall, Urartu... this is before I was in the podcast, but Urartu started expanding, I believe, before Tiglath-Pileser III, right? He sort of stopped it.
Yes.
So then he built a lot of forts along there, and this during the time of Sargon, there were just a whole bunch of different incidents. So here these examples will show kind of how the the information got to them. So you had your governors, and the governors were required to send, you know, information back to the kings. So on this area where Urartu is kind of bumping up against the, you know, the Syrian heartland, it's there's mountains there, the rivers are there, there's tributaries of the rivers, and there's also lots of lumber. And the Assyrians would bring the lumber down, you know, they would put them on these rafts and send them down the river. And you get the sense that there's these this little small scale like engagements just happening all the time. So there's three governors on the Assyrian side, and there's multiple governors on the Urartu side. And the Assyrians have forts along the river. Okay, so here's some reports that we have from the Urartan border, right? So this area was ripe with trees, and the Assyrians needed the trees. And we could talk more about the trees after, but... So the main task of the Assyrian officials was to monitor the Urartan frontier and warn the court about any impending insurrections or stuff like that. And there's this one, it's called the Palua crisis. So a report on this Palua crisis has been preserved on some tablets. And some of them they're not all 100% complete, but we get enough from them. And this guy's name is Asipa. So Asipa's dispatch: "The third man of the king, my lord, who came, told me, your guard should be strong. The guard is very strong. Three governors in Palula and another three in Dinibi are gathered with pack animals opposite us. We are keeping watch opposite them. All the people are inside fortified palaces. The oxen and sheep are on this side of the river. We are standing by and keeping watch." So, according to this report, it's telling them about the tension on the border, right? And the king was aware of this escalating tension, so he told Asipa just to keep a close eye on events. So he watched carefully. He kept providing the court with intelligence, and he had some more intelligence for him here. "Six Urartan governors with pack animals took their position along the banks of the Murat." So he communicated this intelligence on the rank, the number, and the location of all the military commanders, right? Who they were, the latest information provided by this Asipa was the account of his defensive countermeasures. So he moved his people into the fortified palaces, and he moved his domestic animals to the other side of the river.
Okay.
So he strengthens his guard, he takes advantage of the situation, and then he asks the king to supply him another 500 men from another province to supply his guard. And that's you know, example of a Syrian intelligence report. But what happened is Sargon, and they knew about this, but it wasn't that big of a deal. So they actually didn't send the 500 men, but there was a lot of stuff going on battle-wise, but they couldn't spare anything. So you also get these other reports where they're like, well, the one guy says to the guy, governor sends the other one something like, "I hope you are well, you know, I hope everything is well." And he sends him back, you hope everything is well. You must be happy, you know, being safe in your house, because there's troops all over the place here and they're attacking us. So there was all these battles going on. And they were constantly, you know, letting the king know what's happening. But he doesn't always have somebody to send in the army, you know, today. So I get the sense from all these different reports that there was all these fires just going on all outside around the empire. And that's how the king had to decide which his annual campaign was going to be. Like, do I have to go to Elam this year? Do I have to go to, you know, Babylon now? Where do I have to go? To Jerusalem? Who's rebelling? And you can only pick one a year, I guess. So then you needed the intelligence services to have these psychological operations, know what's going on, know where the worst fires are going to be. And then, like, when you do go fight somebody, that's why I think they slaughtered the hell out of them, because then they could use those psychological operations, you know, to, like, because you can't fight 13 wars at a time, you know, if you have 13 different, you know, areas that are inflamed, so to speak.
We do know which year this was?
These are during the time of Sargon, so it's like 708, 711, like this time period.
Okay.
It's when Sargon was king.
I wonder what the Urartans were up to.
So the Urartans, they had built a highway and connected all their peripheries with Lake Van. So I remember, too, they said that highway had, you know, torches. So if the Syrians came, they light one torch, they'd see it, and then that's how they could mobilize. So they indicated that the Urartans were able to mobilize when the Assyrians, every time the Assyrians, you know, tried to fight back. So it was a really contested border, And it's, you know, and today we have nuclear weapons, so you can't have these, you know, border skirmishes, but I got the appearance that they're pretty much fighting all the time, you know?
Yes. It's very ambitious from Urartu. They are so good at copying Assyrian stuff.
Yeah. They even have some. It's very limited, but they'll have some. He could kind of extrapolate, too, that they know what the... Because the Urartans obviously have some spies and that kind of thing, too. Because, you know, that's what you have. You have actual spies out in the field. Those are like scouts. And then you have, you know, your provincial governor. He gets the information. And he sends it to the king. Also, then you have your vassal kings, and they provide information, and they send it to the governor, and then he sends it to the king, or to Sennacherib, who then sends a dispatch to the king. It's very like the CIA, but they just don't call it that.
Is it possible this Russian border trouble is before 715 BC?
Yes, around 715.
Because in 715, Sargon decides to attack.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Kurator for real.
That would be eventually he got sick of it.
Yes, and also he probably knew about the Urartus, the Urartian trouble with the Cimmerians.
He probably did. And, you know, they don't mention anything about that in Dombowski's book. Doesn't say anything about the Cimmerians in that, but he obviously did know. I mean, they also made their vassal kings, like, they would sometimes lie. So that's why they would, when three people or four people would give their reports, they would have to like say, oh, this guy's lying now. And that's how they know. They would say these things like, oh, this guy was, turned out he was, you know, lying to me. And that's why he was, you know, they went and he disappeared or whatever. Relations between Assyria and Urartu, they alternated between standoffs in which both parties respected each other's territory and the right into overt armed conflicts, such as this. There's a Palua crisis and a Harda crisis. So the main task of the Assyrian officials was to monitor the frontier and warn the imperial court about any insurrections. So a report on the Palua crisis has been preserved in the form of this guy, Asipa's dispatch. The third man of the king, my lord, who came, told me, your guard should be strong. The guard is very strong. Three governors in Padua and another three in another province are gathered with pack animals opposite us. We are keeping watch opposite them. All the people are inside fortified palaces. The oxen and the sheep are on this side of the river. We're standing by and keeping watch. So according to these lines, this report is only one among many reports informing the court about the tension on the border. The king was already aware of the escalating tension, and he just ordered him to stay at this Asipa guy to keep a close eye on events. So watching carefully, he provided the royal court with the following intelligence. Six Urartan governors with pack animals took their position along the banks of the Murat. So thus he communicated on the intelligence, the rank, the number, and the location of the Urartan military commanders and on the combatant corps of the Urartan troops. So like from the history of intelligence, this like showing that this is what intelligence services do. Like, if you were talking about an intelligence report, you know, from the CIA, it would be sort of structured like this. So, furthermore, he told him what he did. He strengthened his guard and he took advantage of the situation. So he asked the king to send him another 500 men. And then there's the Harda crisis. There's three reports relating a similar escalation in tension in Harda. And this came from the governor of Amedi. His name is Lipforbel. That usually means Lord. So he's like, you know, I'm like a magnet. Information about this crisis was acquired from two sources, a diplomatic envoy and some spies. So you can sketch it out as follows. The Urartans made a foray into the territory under Assyrian control and captured some border fortresses. And this, you know, raid was more like a scouting foray, was organized under the Urartan governor and his deputy, opposite of the Amedi province. So the city of Harda became the center in which Urartan troops were assembled, and then the Urartan frontier was closely watched. As for the foray, it was not a simple border cross. So Lipforbel reported that, quote, "The levied Urartan troops are positioned town by town in battle array as far as Turuspa. The mobilization was ordered by the Urartan king himself. As to the work I ordered you, the governor of Harda, to do, don't do it. Feed your horses until I send you a messenger." So this interruption of assigned work, it constituted a clear warning that attack could shortly befall the Assyrians. And it was actually archaeologists have confirmed this little story here. And so, and like I said before, I think we mentioned that the Urartans had a highway. Sometime in the 700s, they built this long highway to connect the Lake Van region. And it's today, it's still there. So,
wow.
Yeah, it goes through 3,000 high mountains. It's like on the border of Turkey and, you know, Iraq. Hold on now.
I'm very curious which year this is, but I think it's before 715.
Yeah, well, I'm going to find it before, but make sure I squeeze it in there. So for the most part, this ancient highway follows the modern highway. There's bridges and stuff, and I mean, it's an amazing highway. So by them positioning the troops town by town in a battle array, and that most likely meant the mobilization of all the forts, the fortresses, all the fortified cities along this highway, connected all the way to their king. So this shows you how they did their intelligence. You know, they had these scouting stations all along this highway. So when these road stations, when they're put on high alert, that assured fast communication in case the Assyrians decide to retaliate. So on the basis of what we know, the Assyrians did not retaliate, but they just limited their response to some negotiations and strengthening their guards. So this Lipforbel, he was ordered to send his messengers to talk to the Urartan government for violating the treaty. Says, "Why do you capture our forts while we are at peace?"
Good question.
Yeah. So Lipforbel was ordered to send his messengers to say to the Urartan government, you know, "Why are you violating the Assyrian treaty? Why do you capture our forts?" Apparently, the Urartan government just gave an arrogant answer, which is lost, but you know, the records say that he gave an arrogant answer. So this guy's mission failed. But this shows you again how the governor's mission was to keep information to the king on what's going on in the border. It was also his mission to sort of act as a, you know, diplomat and go and try to, you know, defuse the situation. So in this situation, you know, the Urartans kind of got the best of the Assyrians. 707.
Wow.
Abundant intelligence reports covering the situation and this transitional area are preserved in the correspondence of four Assyrian officials. Lipforbel, the government of Amedi, who was in office in 705 BC, Ashur Durbla, the governor of Masinu, and two officials of Tuscan, Asipa and Sa Ashur Dubu, after having been the governor of Tushan in 707.
Okay, so that's very late in Sargon's reign.
Yeah, right before he died. I hope that I just get the sense that there was a lot of stuff happening on all these borders that the Assyrians were not loved. They were like really pissed a lot of people off. They're always trying to rebel from them, especially when you come in and, you know, skin a whole bunch of people and cut down their cities and capture your women and children. I imagine that makes you unloved. They were constantly trying to put these fires out with this kind of stuff.
But I think that we have to remark on the timing of Sargon's great attack against the Urartu in 715, because he seems to have perfect intelligence at the time. He knows
absolutely
the Sumerians are invading Urartu and the Manians are rebelling because he beat them up the year before. Yes. And told them to rebel, and they are against Urartu.
Yes.
So while both these things are going on, he attacks. And that seems to be an indication that his intelligence is pretty good.
Yeah. You know, something else about intelligence services is, and I learned this from, you know, some of my studying about just in general. I think, and I've always thought this, I think they're so secret that after a couple generations, they forget. Like, they don't really tell the next generation what exactly to do.
Yeah.
Because you have, like, Tiglath-Pileser and Sargon and then Sennacherib. And then by the time we get to Ashurbanipal, he wasn't really supposed to be the emperor. So maybe he didn't get all the information. And then, you know, he was a good warrior, I guess. But then after him, kind of fell apart.
Problem with secrecy.
Exactly. Isn't that crazy? I think about, like, on the X-Files, the smoking man, like, you know, like, all the information's gone. Whatever maybe those people knew, if there was such a thing, you know?
I also remember Sargon's daughter who kept writing intelligence reports to him.
Really? Now, that didn't come up in my studies. That's interesting.
He married his daughter to some borderland king, and then he got reports from her.
So I do recommend this book for anyone who's really interested in taking a deep dive, because there's so many different case studies in there, but it is scholarly, but if you read through it, you can kind of get the idea. So it's very difficult to explain each situation, at least for me.
I bet there's more coming out from all these clay tablets that haven't been read yet.
I'm sure. And it's, I mean, I tell you, I read a paragraph one time and I thought that paragraph would have taken me a day to write that. I mean, you have to reference every piece of a tablet. My goodness, I appreciate the scholars who do this work, that's for sure.
Do we have more information on spies?
Yeah, here's a little spy information here. This is more of like how about a covert operation?
Oh.
There was this guy, his name, we won't go into the whole backstory, but this guy's name is Lutu, right? And it was an area that the Assyrians, their king decided to become a vassal king. But his brother, Lutu, didn't want to become, he wasn't good with that. So, to pacify this guy, so he kind of rebelled, right? And he got some horsemen together and stuff. So to rebel, to pacify this guy, they orchestrated this covert action. They kidnapped his son.
Okay.
And they took him, and then they moved him, like they secretly transferred him. They got him over a mountain pass, and they took him to Kar Sarukhan. And it was all performed according to plan. And so once his son was under guard under the walls, then the court told the governor of that area to write an angry letter voicing the king's strong disapproval of Lutu's behavior. So having his son in their hands, the Assyrians could dictate their terms. So, unfortunately, that's all we have. We don't know exactly what happened because the tablet is broken, but I thought that was another cool story.
Yeah, he probably kept tabs on his son and were surprised to find him missing.
Like, where is he? Right? So, then They could also find out, you know, there's another guy's name is Aspabera, and his brother was Lutu, right? So he was supposed to be fighting against his brother, but it turns out that his brother, they knew, only had 20 cavalrymen, but there was another 80 cavalrymen in this certain, you know, group that was, you know, making trouble. And this Aspabera guy, he was supposedly a vassal, so he sent he sent a letter back to the king of Urartu saying, no, I'm an Assyrian, you know, I'm loyal to the Assyrian king, sorry. But he actually did give some of his troops to his brother, but he tried to disguise them. But because one of their spies knew, they were able to give that information to the king. And they warned the court about that he's, you know, a duplicitous. He's basically not doing what he says.
Good intelligence work.
Yeah. So they make clear, so he turned from being a pro-Assyrian vassal who is secretly plotting all along. Interesting, right? So they really had their spies all around.
Do we have more spy stories?
The only other psyops you could, well, we sort of mentioned it before, but the way that they conquered Babylon, the way Sargon got into Babylon. I mean, Sennacherib had to siege Babylon, but Sennacherib, he really worked with inside the temple people. He found out who was against what.
You mean Sargon?
Yeah, Sargon.
Yes, you said Sennacherib.
Oh, I said Sennacherib. Yeah, Sargon. Yeah, Sennacherib didn't do it the right way. Sargon worked there's a damaged tablet that an intelligence agent says, a citizen of Babylon, in quotes, provided the Assyrian court with some information about the about what was going on in Babylon and about the king of Elam. So at the time that Sargon walked into Babylon, just like Cyrus walked into Babylon and Alexander the Great walked in, he knew that there was trouble going on in the temple. He knew he utilized this. Utilize it so that he can get the doors open. And he also knew where the Elamite army was so that he was able to, you know, do that operation, not get caught with his pants down, you know, and land in front of be outside of Babylon, and then the Elamite army comes and get him. I mean, you know what I said before about the generational thing? I mean, just think about the massive intelligence failure of the Medes and the Babylonians showing up outside of Assur sometime maybe in the future.
Yes.
Right?
They would have needed Sargon then.
Right. That's my point about how this intelligence services was really probably Sargon, Sennacherib. By the time Ashurbanipal, he must have let it fall apart.
Interesting stuff.
It is very interesting stuff. And I do recommend, if you want further information, to check out this book by Dubofsky. It's called Hezekiah and the Assyrian Spies. It's a very scholarly book, but it's also very, very interesting.
And with that, we are about to return to the 630s BC.
Yes. And I think Assyria is going to be a little bit quiet in the 630s as far as what we know. I'm sure a lot of this stuff that we just talked about was happening all the time. But we're really winding it. I know there's more information on the 20s, but the 630s in Assyria is very sparse. But we know stuff was happening, so we're going to discuss it.
And we know if the Assyrians don't tell us what is happening, it is not good for them.
That's right. That's why they don't tell us very much.
We are getting closer to the end of the Neo-Assyrian Empire in 612.
Yes. But I think, you know who starts getting born now and start coming around? They call the pre-Socratics. So that's how the world's going to sort of shift that way in a couple hundred years. But the pre-Socratics are like philosophers who were precluded, you know, preceded.
Oh, interesting.
So they start to come around. They start getting born in the late 600s and start operating in the 500s.
Oh, well, the 6th century BC is a great time for philosophy.
Yeah. Yes, it is. That's why they get started. We think of it in the 300s, but anyway, we'll talk about that then, right?
Yes.
Excellent. Well.
So I hope you have enjoyed this story of the Assyrian Empire and how it actually worked, and that you now have a better picture of this thing we've been talking about for so long.
Yes.
Now let's tear it down.
Yeah, let's rip it apart. Well, I think most people know when it is, but we still have the 630s, we have the 20s, and we have other parts of the world. So again, if anybody has any information on, you know, East Asia, India history specifically in those, you know, decades, that's always a problem. We have big era stuff, but it's hard to like pinpoint a decade. I would appreciate it.
Very good. And if you'd like to support our show, please do so on patreon.com. where you can donate a sum per episode of your choice.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Check out our Facebook page. Send me messages.
And now I'm quite happy to get back to our chronological narrative that we are used to.
Yes. It's been a while. So we appreciate you letting us go through this little sidebar. And we're right back to the 630s next time.
And 28 years of dismantling this gigantic empire into nothing.
Amazing. All right, well, let's do it.
We would like to thank our sponsors on Patreon for being so great and being sponsors.
Yes.
There are 9 sponsors at the $1 level. Thank you all. And then we will give personal thanks to everyone above that level. Thanks to Frank Hick. Thanks to Brian Donahue. And please excuse me if I pronounce your English names wrong. I am very sorry. English is not my native language. Thanks to Sir Robert. Thanks to Chris Cork.
So far, so good. You speak better English than me.
Well, thanks to Sir Robert and Chris Cork, I don't think I speak better English than you. Thanks to, oh, here are some Swedish sponsors. Thanks to Ulrika. Thanks to Martin Olsson and Roland Magnusson.
Thank you.
Thanks to Johan Sträng, who is at a very special level, namely the Marduk Lord God of Babylon level. So Johan, if you send a message on Patreon, we will do something special for you. We also have two sponsors on the $5 level, which we have aptly named Most Excellent Lord Sponsors. You also have a reward if you send a message on Patreon. Those two people are Matt McGavin. You know him, don't you?
Yes, he's a super fan.
And Nicholas Barton. Thank you, guys. We also want to extend a special thanks to the Endless Knot podcasts, of which you are a listener, Bernie, are you not?
Yes, I definitely am. Very interesting.
Check it out. It's a great podcast.
Definitely is.
Thank you all. This is what keeps us going. So we are most thankful.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Me and Dan go drinking with the money right after.
No, we're not.
No, we're not, because he lives in Sweden and I live in Pennsylvania.
One day, we'll do
one day
tour
we'll
of
have
Iraq and the Assyrian heartland.
Oh, that'll be amazing. I just got a GoPro camera, so we'll be ready to go.
Okay, we need much more sponsors than that for that.
I'll just use my own retirement money.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Speak to you soon, Bernie.
Yes, cheers. Thanks, Dan.
Cheers.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just $1 an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.